Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Saturday, May 21st, 2011. Members, we have one item on the agenda, and it's Senate File 1369, the Omnibus Retirement Bill, authored by Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of your committee. I really appreciate this chance to present the Omnibus Pension Bill in front of you. Senate File 1369 is basically, there was a whole bunch of introductions on pension bills this year, and this is just the ones that need immediate attention and need to move forward that are going to save the money, save the state some money. And I have Larry Martin to go into more detail, but there is a Minsku defined benefit default for newly hired employees from the Minsku division. So they're changed from the defined contribution to a defined benefit TRA. There's a White Bear Lake interim actuarial valuation. There's the Duluth St. Paul teacher benefit adjustment. It's very important that will save the fund and the state some money. There's the MnDOT survivor benefit increase. Mike Struck, who was the employee from MnDOT that was killed in the line of duty in an emergency down by Mankato when he was trying to clean out a culvert. This is a very tightly crafted piece of legislation for Mike Struck and his family, his widow, and his children. We've had 49 of these tightly crafted exemptions in the last 50 years. And then there is the actuarial assumptions revisions. There's a small group individual provision that includes Senator Tomasoni's para service credit purchase for certain former employees of Babbitt and Buell, Senator Howe's para coverage for employees of the Red Wing Port Authority, Senator Tomasoni's Hibbing Relief Association report deadline extension, and Senator Olson's TRA salary credit purchase for Hopkins part-time teacher. And Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Martin.
Welcome, Mr. Martin. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. The 2011 Omnibus Pension Bill is broken into five articles. They're grouped by either pension plan that's involved or type of pension plan or policy area that's affected. I'll go through very quickly. The first article has to do with PERA plans. This is two different changes. One is continuing and validating the service credit and contributions that the Red Wing Port Authority has made for its employees to PERA. Port authorities, with the exception of the St. Paul Port Authority, are not covered employing units by PERA. That was not noticed in the 1980s when the Port Authority was created. And members have long service credits, and there are even some retirees of the Red Wing Port Authority. I believe this committee heard this bill as a separate bill earlier during this session. And those are validated. The only change from the bill that the committee heard previously would be that the inclusion of Port Authority, Red Wing Port Authority employees in PERA is restricted to existing employees and would not cover new employees. The other change here in the first article has to do with the Duluth City and Duluth Airport Authority. There was 2009 legislation that provided a mechanism for those two employing units to resolve an overstatement and an over-reporting of contributions to PERA having to do with a misunderstanding as to covered salary in PERA by those two jurisdictions. For various reasons related to appeals and other process items in Duluth, those two entities have not were not able to approve the piece of legislation from 2009 in a timely fashion. So this reenacts the 2009 provision now that those appeals have been cleared up and provides them with a manner to clean up the salary problem in those two jurisdictions. Article 2 has to do with teacher pension coverage. It deals with the St. Paul teachers, the Duluth teachers, and Minsku and TRA. For the St. Paul teachers, which did not do as many of the various fiscal sustainability items as other pension plans in 2010, this extends a number of those changes from 2010 into the St. Paul Teacher Plan. It changes, it lowers the post-retirement adjustment mechanism, setting the maximum post-retirement adjustment based on funding ratios. It also lowers the deferred annuities augmentation rate. It reduces the interest rate on refunds, and it eliminates the interest on reemployed annuitant earning limitations deferrals. For Duluth teachers, the Duluth teachers in 2010 created a five-year vesting provision rather than a three-year vesting provision for its service pension, its normal age retirement annuity, but it did not make those same changes for early retirement and survivor and disability benefits, and those are made now across the board. For Minsky, Senator Rosen has briefly discussed this clarifies the default for employees who are hired by Minsky who have previous coverage in a defined benefit plan, provides for more counseling and makes a more appropriate default coverage if the member does not make a choice. Article 3 is the base bill. It's updating salary scale and payroll increase assumptions for four pension plans: the general employee plan of the state retirement system, the general plan for PERA, the Teacher Retirement Association, and also the PERA police and fire plan. And these are all in conformity with the most recent actuarial experience study that's been filed with the Pension Commission. Article 4 has to do with volunteer fire plans. Senator Rosen covered this briefly. It assists Hibbing, which for whatever reason did not make a timely filing for its 2010 fire state aid, and extends the deadline to May 1st. And it's our understanding from Senator Tomasoni that they have now filed the appropriate financial reporting, and then this would qualify them for their 2010 fire state aid distribution. This also clarifies the circumstances in White Bear Lake and avoids a municipal contribution, which would not be unnecessary, validates some interim actuarial work that has been subsequently replicated in full-blown actuarial work that the pension plan is recovering now from the Great Recession. Article 5 is the small group or one-person provisions. There are two. There's one service credit purchase. This is the a full-time Babbitt City police officer who has some part-time police officer periods that were not reported properly to PERA dating back to the 1990s, and this requires a full actuarial value purchase by the member and by the cities involved, Buell and Babbitt. The member pays the member contribution the member would have paid had they been properly reported to PERA plus interest, and the cities involved pay the balance of the obligation due on a full actuarial basis. It also covers a Hopkins School District teacher who is in the middle of a part-time teaching full-time service credit program at the end of her career. She needs to purchase the full-time equivalent service or salary credit that she would have received had her school district properly reported her part-time status in 2008. And again, the teacher involved would make the member contribution that member would have made had the reporting been done appropriately, and the school district pays the balance of the full actuarial value cost of the extra service credit. And then the last item in Article 5, Section 3, is the provision which creates an additional survivor benefit for the surviving family of Mr. Strzok, the Minnesota flood response employee who was tragically killed. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I would be happy to answer questions, but that covers briefly the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Do we have questions from the members here? Senator Gazelka.
I'll kick it off. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, as far as the Minsky defined benefit default, why are we changing them from a defined contribution individual retirement to a defined benefit retirement?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, individuals who have prior defined benefit service credit, who have been longtime employees covered by TRA or PERA, typically are better served by continuing that defined benefit pension plan coverage rather than having a shift mid-career to a defined contribution plan. And this better reflects what their judgment tends to be when they do make a considered choice. Frequently, when individuals are newly hired, they're more concerned about learning their new employment responsibilities and doing other things related to being a new employee of a different employer, that they don't bother to make the choice. They let it slide. And the current default is always the defined contribution plan. We have received over the past couple of years a number of instances where individuals have made the wrong choice by virtue of not doing it in a more timely fashion, getting the default choice and coming back with special legislative requests to have a second chance at the option.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Martin, so if it's a brand new employee, they've not worked anyplace else, and now they're at Minsky, do they have those options, multiple options?
Mr. Martin?
Defined contribution, defined benefit.
My understanding is that the default is not changed for them, that the default is only changed if they have prior Minnesota defined benefit plan coverage.
Yeah, but
Senator
Mr. Chair,
Gazelka.
For clarity then, I just want to make sure, if you're a brand new employee for Minsky, do you have a choice where you could accept a defined benefit plan still, or you can go to a defined contribution plan? And the reason why I'm asking that question is in many places your only choice is a defined contribution plan, and, you know, which to me, you know, frankly, the defined benefit plan is a more benefit-rich plan for the employee. And so if they're moving there and all the rest of the new people can't get that, that's the question I'm asking.
Mr. Martin.
Luther Thompson or someone up here. I'm not sure I can give him a question or answer the question.
Mr. Chair, if we could get Mr. Thompson up.
Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, Luther Thompson, representing TRA. The current procedure, if you go to Minsky, you have a one-year period of time to make an election. And if you make no election, you're defaulted into IRAP. If you make an election into TRA, it only starts at the time you make that election. So it could be 3 or 4 months into the process, or 8 or 9 months, and then you end up with a block of time there that's sort of sitting at IRAP that doesn't get converted over to TRA. There is a provision that after you receive tenure and you're in IRAP, you can make another election to come to TRA, but you have to make the full actuarial contribution for that service, and you have to buy back all prior service, and that's very expensive. This provision has come up because of the people that have prior service in MSRS or TRA. They're usually been in the technical college or the two-year community college, and they go to work for Minsky. They may not even understand that they're getting put into a different plan, and it usually comes up then that they've discovered beyond the one-year period of time that if anybody was counseling them, they certainly would have selected TRA. So this only provides for new people who go to Minsky, who have prior allowable service in one of the three pension plans, that they can continue. The default is to continue that service unless they choose to go to IRAP, and they can make that choice. There's also a provision in here that mandates additional counseling on behalf of Minsky for all of the new people over there.
Further discussion, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, I have a question regarding the option to switch from the IRAP to the TRA after tenure. What would we do for those coaches at our Minscu systems that can't get tenure because they only are allowed to be fixed term because of the nature of their position? Is there ever a point? I have a particular constituent that is stuck in this position where he would love to get back to TRA because he was given some bad information about 8 years ago and didn't know better and just wanted to coach. And so did the IRAP thing and moved on, and now he'd really like to get back to TRA and is wondering how can he get there when he can't get tenure. And yet he'll be in the university system probably for the rest of his life. Is there anything we can do to help people in those particular circumstances?
Mr. Thompson.
Senator Carlson, there is not an election for a person of that background in the statute now. But he does have the option of coming to you to draft a special member bill if there were some extenuating circumstances, if he wasn't properly counseled, you know, if Minscu made a mistake, they could, you know, come to you and you would go to the Pension Commission and gather the facts and see if it merited legislative consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Thompson, thanks for being here today. In follow-up to Senator Gazelka's question, I'm not sure that I heard the answer with respect to new employees. Brand new employees not transferring from another organization, do they have an option for defined contribution or defined benefit, or are they defaulted into the defined contribution?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Daley, I'm sorry if I didn't answer that completely. No, if you're a new employee with no prior allowable service, your default is into IRAP. You do have a one-year period of time to make an election into TRA if you so choose. So a newly employed person from Minscu with no prior allowable service in any, you know, assuming, you know, this particular bill, the way it is now, any employee in Minscu, whether you have allowable service or not, is defaulted into IRAP. And you have that one-year period of time to make an election into TRA. And once you make that election, then your service in TRA is prospective only. You can't go back and transfer that other 6-7 months that you've neglected to make the election. With this bill, if this bill is passed, then still any newly hired person with no allowable service in any of the three pension plans will be defaulted into IRAP if they don't make a choice to elect TRA.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, on a different subject here.
Senator Gazelka.
The MnDOT survivor benefit increase, you talked about there's been 49 of these in the last 50 years. Is it about every time there's a death like this? Is that typically why there's 49? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Senator Sharon here to explain the circumstances on this, but because of his age and the unusual circumstances on this emergency flood situation, I think you can go back in history and look at the provisions or the exemptions. They have all been critical, and with a young widow like this. So we've had just two pension hearings, actually three, but the first two, we dealt with this provision very thoroughly. They went back and got an agreement from the Department of Transportation on the funding to move this forward. And if there's any other questions, Mr. Martin or Senator Sharon can ask.
Senator Gazelka.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, do we know how much the state provided in life insurance?
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Rosen.
I do not know if Senator Sharon would like to say, or Mr. Martin, do you?
Mr. Martin.
My understanding that the state supplied life insurance is twice a person's income up to a certain dollar amount, and I don't think that Mr. Strzok would have been at that dollar amount.
Mr. Chair. Chair, I believe it's $90,000, an accidental death benefit under a state employee life insurance policy of double his salary or $90,000.
Thank you.
I don't.
Do we have all do the members have those?
There is something that was put together. It looks like from Mr. Watson, counsel, on this particular bill, on those, on the benefits. And maybe it would be good if we made copies and passed that around.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Members, for your benefit, I just want to point out that part of the agreement that was reached was that $38,000 needed to be paid, and those funds were going to come from the Department of Transportation. And I talked to our transportation chair, and he said, oh, that'll come out of operations and maintenance funds from the Department of Transportation. So there was some concern, some question about how that was going to work, and I just want to share that information as far as appropriations go and that whole process. I'm not exactly clear how that works.
Further discussion. I have a couple of questions.
Mr. Chair.
Who? Oh, Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps we could ask Mr. Bodern to help me understand this. My understanding is that the Constitution of the state says that we are not allowed to pass laws that affect single individuals, and this would appear to do that. I understand that there are ways to work around that. Could you please help us understand what that constitutional requirement is and how we have worked around it in this situation?
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly, and I'll defer to Mr. Martin on this somewhat because he has quite a bit of experience with this in pension legislation. You'll see that the individuals are not named, and a description is given that may fit that particular individual. That's sort of the immediate method that is used to deal with that problem. So I think it's by naming a class of one, as it were. I can get the Constitution and think about this a little bit more and follow up with you. Mr. Martin may have something in addition.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members, the only thing I could add is there's a long tradition in the Minnesota legislature of defining classes that happen to be of one entity or one person. Before the Minnesota Constitution was amended in 1957 to permit local laws, this is how the legislature basically enacted all legislation that are related to one jurisdiction or one county. That same practice has been continued after the 57 constitutional amendment that did permit the naming of particular jurisdictions in local laws in cases like this where there are one or a small group of people and a class of one or that small group would be defined. We can trace back pension laws back to 1957 or 1959 doing this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, didn't we a couple weeks ago address a concern at a hardship that Senator Carlson, I believe, brought to us where coverage had lapsed and legislation was designed to address a specific person, if I recall correctly?
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Wigger. You are correct about that. The circumstances are a little bit different. Mm-hmm. There's no cost to the state. Here we're talking about probably a substantial cost to the state. It's certainly a very touchy subject when you're dealing with such a heartfelt situation. But members, I have to remind you what happened at the World Trade Center, where over 3,000 people lost their lives. And the federal government, in its wisdom, decided to give benefits to those individuals that lost their lives, and perhaps that was a good thing. But what struck me as a little odd about that situation is they looked at each individual and they asked, did you have life insurance? Did you have the foresight to protect your family with life insurance? And many did. And they proceeded to subtract that amount. So members, there's no benefit, it appears, for anyone to have the foresight to protect their family and buy life insurance when a situation like this comes up. And this is really hard. This is a really hard one for me. I don't know if anyone else wants to weigh in on that.
Senator Ortman.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your willingness to give this bill a hearing. These are complex issues, and they're very important issues. There are so many people relying on us to get these issues right. But I did want to speak and follow up to the comments about this one particular provision. I'm equally troubled by it. I think it was a tragic set of circumstances by which Mr. Strzok lost his life, and I extend my condolences to the family. However, this may be not unprecedented, but I don't support the precedent by which Mr. Strzok's widow would be compensated more than under current law provisions and insurance would provide. I don't think that's a good precedent, regardless of the fact that it may be a precedent. I don't think that it's government's responsibility to go above and beyond in this case. Because in this case, if we compensate beyond the state's current obligations to do that, then we will find so many other cases similar to this in the future. And it's not an easy thing to say, but in this case, it's very difficult, in fact. But I think I can't support this provision, and I think that it should be taken out so that this bill can survive, so that we can continue forward working on this bill. And so, Mr. Chair, I would like to move to take this section out. I think it's Article 5, Section 3.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I would just like to make a few comments. First of all, I know how it's interesting now because I sat for 4 years with Cal Larson, who served on the Pension Commission forever. And then Senator Betsy Wergen also was on the Pension Commission, and they used to talk about how delicate the pensions are and how you have to be very careful what you do with the pensions, and it has to be methodical. However, there is always exemptions to the rule going forward. And like I said earlier, there was 49 of these similar cases in the last 50 years. We deliberated, like I said, two pension hearings on this provision. I would like to note on this handout that was just passed out from Mr. Watson, the counsel to the governor, on April 14th.
Senator Sharon, let me just stop
Senator
you
Rosen.
There because I yeah.
But I want to, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a correction on this.
Well, let me do this first, Senator Ortman.
Yeah.
I've been told by counsel that we do have a delete all amendment that we should really move before we move forward on anything else. I was wondering if you would withdraw your motion, and then I'll see if somebody will move the A6 so we can get to that point.
Mr. Chair, I would do that. I would withdraw my motion and move to adopt the delete all the 6A.
All right, motion by Senator Ortman to adopt the 6A amendment, delete all amendment. All in favor? Favor signify.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, is this in the spirit of an author's friendly amendment?
Senator Rosen.
I don't have it in front of me.
It's
I mean the whole. So.
Is that what we have?
We're working out of it.
Okay. Well, it's in your packets, member. It's the 6A amendment.
So you're just offering what we had.
Right, exactly.
It's the delete all, or it's the author's amendment.
Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment prevails.
Mr. Chair, now may I make the motion?
Yes, you may.
And are the I think it is still the section, Article 5, Section 3 on page 31 through 33. I would move to delete that language from the bill as amended.
Senator Rosen, to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Watson's description of this provision has, on April 14th, was changed in the second commission hearing to, on the back, on the second page, it says the 54% of the 3,750 was changed to 54% was changed to 34% of the average of his average monthly salary. So that would bring it down from a change from approximately $2,000 to $1,385. And then she would still get the $191 per month. So this is not a windfall by any means. This is what she, so what is that about?
Mr. Chair?
$20,000 total per year. So it's absolutely not a windfall. And I guess I'm asking for to respect the vote that came out of the Pension Commission.
Further discussion from the committee. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to speak in support of Senator Ortman's motion. Obviously, the individual isn't named, but there's no question what the intent of this is, and it's the Constitution. We should pay attention to it, and I would therefore encourage the members to support Senator Ortman's motion.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to
Senator Rosen.
It was pointed out to me she doesn't get this for another 28 years.
Further discussion. Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I ask if Senator Shern could address the committee on the amendment?
She may if she would like. Welcome, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, and thank you for considering this proposal, pension benefit for the family of Mike Strzok. I understand what the, at least I understand two issues in the request to delete this provision from this bill. One is concerns about whether or not we should be doing something that's unique for an individual, and I think the response to that's pretty fair. We haven't put something that's unique to an individual, but we've narrowly defined this so that it would be very rare. And so concerns about how broadly are we doing something that would create an obligation for the state is minuscule. As a matter of fact, the Department of Transportation reported, and I'll ask Senator Rosen to help my memory on this or any others who are here that were at those pension meetings, that the frequency with which they've had anything close to this happen in the last 20 years is non-existent. So so the issue of the individual, I think, is resolved in how we've written the language. The second is the issue that Senator Ortman is, her reasoning for wanting to delete this. And I would just remind you that the unique character of what we're talking about here is a person who like others that we already provide similar kinds of survivor benefits for, this bill was originally crafted after benefits for people who are police officers or people who are firefighters who have really high probability of dying in the line of trying to protect the public. And the problem with the original bill was that we hadn't calculated in the fact that the difference between how Social Security is treated between the various kinds of employees of the state. So it was modified and changed, and I know that the people from the pension board can certainly answer those questions more clearly. And so we've really reduced the benefit, but we recognize that what was unique in this situation is that this particular employee was asked to do something in an emergency situation, a situation that was creating an unsafe condition for the public. It wasn't the normal duties of a person in his employment in terms of doing road construction or the typical activities of doing line work that are related to the Minnesota Department of Transportation. This person was called out and was engaged in a very dangerous activity in order to resolve a problem that was occurring in the River Valley around Mankato. So it was the condition itself, it was the flooding itself, it was the crisis of the environment itself that took his life. And that's very different than any other kind of situation, more similar to a person who has had unique benefits given to them before. There were examples presented in the Pensions Committee of a person who was going to do an assessment in a home about whether or not they were meeting building code requirements, and the person shot them. You know, these are just very rare situations in which we ask employees to place themselves in very dangerous situations, and that it's rare, not in the last 16 or 20 years, the department said, has anything like this ever happened. But we got caught in a situation here where it was a young employee, hadn't really been able to be in the system long enough to provide or to feed into his pension program enough to adequately support a young family. Now, the family does get other benefits. The spouse does not receive this money until a retirement age. But the other resources that they have will help her raise her two children, pay for their health insurance, get them educated, maybe get them through college if they can get in someplace. So this is really a pension benefit. That's what it is. It's intended, and the department has stepped up to make the system whole so that if this money is invested now, that it's able to earn through the pension program enough money to pay the benefit in the future. So I'm hoping that you will see that this is a very unique and very different kind of a situation that is narrowly crafted, and that it's incumbent on the state and the public to recognize that, and when it's the responsible thing to stand up and to make a family whole when they have engaged in an activity that goes beyond what their job description is and acted in a way to create public safety for the rest of us.
Further discussion?
Oh, Ms. Chair,
Senator Wigger.
I would oppose the amendment, would ask for a roll call. This was a natural disaster. It was an emergency. It was a crisis. If it was a police officer, firefighter, others, would we make a distinction and allow it? I'm not sure. I haven't served in pension. But if I think the governor has spoken, and I'll withdraw the roll call, but I oppose.
Further discussion, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I also oppose the motion. I think Senator Sharon did a nice job of explaining the unique circumstances here. So it's not precedential in nature. I think she also did a nice job of explaining the differentiation, as did Senator Rosen, between the the types of benefits that are coming more immediately in terms of the immediate death benefit, and then the pension benefit, which comes much, much later for the surviving spouse.
Further discussion?
Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
It's kind of how I feel about the whole bill, because it's complicated. And it's the first time I really had a chance to look at it. At this point on the amendment, I'm going to support it, but certainly I'm going to be looking at this in much greater detail before this, whatever package we have, gets to the floor, and I can't promise where I'll be there, just because it takes more time to look at a lot of this stuff.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I appreciate your advocacy on behalf of this family. Nonetheless, I don't think that this is a good plan for the state of Minnesota if you look at it going forward. And it makes me sad to say it, but I don't think that we should do this. And so I would renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
You
Excuse me, say that.
I'm renewing my motion.
Remove your motion?
I'm renewing.
Renewing your motion. All right. Any further discussion? I would just like to make one comment before I call. I find it so interesting that we, the elected people, who take an oath to uphold the Constitution, would find ways to circumvent that Constitution. And I know how easy it is when you get emotional, and I know Senator Dibble will agree with me. We battle over AmVest dollars going to light rail. He knows I don't believe in light rail. I had a bill put together to circumvent the Constitution. And I started sitting in my office thinking, what in the world are you doing? You're letting your emotions, you're letting a tragic event cloud what we are here to do because you're falling victim to your emotions. And that's what bothers me about this, that we here in this committee right now have an opportunity to do what we upheld, to go against what we voted. We all stood on the Senate floor and took an oath to the Constitution. And right now what's happening is that we're trying to circumvent that. All those in favor of the Ortman motion to delete Article 5, Section 3, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No.
Motion prevails. We move on with further discussion. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, there is another amendment I'd like to offer. It's the 14A. And members, the 14A amendment, I don't know whether it's been, has it been handed out yet? It represents an effort on behalf of Minneapolis firefighters, the city of Minneapolis, to consolidate the Firefighters Relief Association. It's a voluntary program, and there are folks here that will testify, Mr. Chair, to outline the amendment and then to answer questions that the committee may have.
Senator Ortman offers the 14A amendment. I believe this is probably one of the longest amendments we've seen in this committee. whole 50,
Mr. Chair, I
did
not
write 52
it.
Pages,
I did
Senator
not write
Ortman.
It.
How do we want to proceed on this? Would you like to explain a little bit more, or do I need to have Mr. Bodern try to walk us through some? Or Senator Ortman and then Mr. Martin?
No, I think it makes sense to have Mr. Martin explain it.
All right, Mr. Martin.
Okay, members, the 14A amendment adds three new articles to the omnibus pension bill. The first two articles are virtual repetitions of each other. The first one has to do with the Minneapolis Fire. The second has to do with the Minneapolis Police. The amendment, as it was originally developed, derived out of Senator Dibble's bill, permitted consolidations of one or other or both of the local relief associations, and so that's why there's this parallel construction. This amendment, as it currently is constituted, really requires either both relief associations consolidate or neither will consolidate. The third article is simply conforming changes if there is a consolidation, doesn't raise any new policy issues. So what's provided for in the first two articles is it permits a voluntary consolidation of the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund and the Minneapolis Fire Pension Fund. The voluntary consolidation requires the approval by several different entities. The board of the Relief Association has to approve it. The membership has to approve it. The board of trustees for PERA has to approve the consolidation. And then the city of Minneapolis has to approve the consolidation. The consolidation of both relief associations is required before the city can take action on the two consolidations. The benefit plans for the Minneapolis Fire and the benefit plans for the Minneapolis Police, for anyone who's currently drawing benefits and for the handful of current active members, stays the same as it currently is constituted in Minnesota Statutes Chapters 423B and 423C. One of the changes, or there are really two changes, instead of having the unit value be derived from the active salaries of current Minneapolis police or fire, this specifies the new unit values for the period 2011 through 2015, and this reflects a settlement of the litigation that's been taking place in Hennepin County District Court and now before the Minnesota Court of Appeals over what the appropriate unit value is for these two plans. After 2015, the 2015 unit value would be increased by whatever the post-retirement increase under the PERA Police and Fire Benefit Plan will be. And if you remember the 2009 legislation, this is capped at 2.5, and then the 2010 legislation caps it at 1.5 until the plan achieves 90% funding ratio. Member contributions of the two relief associations stay the same. It's 8% of the unit value, or the derived salary from the unit value, because these individuals are covered by a provision that relates to active members who have more than 25 years of service. The contributions are actually placed in a defined contribution plan, which is a reimbursement of future medical coverage costs. After the consolidation, the city of Minneapolis is obligated to continue fully funding this plan. The unfunded accrued liability that occurs by moving both our relief associations from their local status over to PERA Police and Fire Administration will be calculated, and the city of Minneapolis is obligated to amortize any unfunded by the year 2031. This is the only place where there is any state fiscal interest. Currently, the Minneapolis Police and Fire receive amortization aid. That amortization aid would go offline when the plan is fully funded. Minneapolis Police has a full funding date of 2020. Minneapolis Fire has a full funding date of 2025. By extending the amortization date to 2031, this does constitute a tail for these two amortization aid payments beyond 2020 or beyond 2025, depending upon the relief association. The total amount of the amortization right at the moment is, I believe, $3.4 million for the pair of them. PERA is the successor in interest to both of the local relief associations, so this means that any litigation that's currently in play, either against the relief association where the our relief association is the plaintiff, would be inherited by PERA. So no one, this will not, by virtue of the consolidation, end anyone's legal rights if there is a legal dispute that has to be resolved. The relief associations are allowed to reformulate themselves as fraternal organizations, which are not pension plans, but can continue to look out for their members, and there are provisions for the continuation of the collection of dues for the organizations. And then with the employees of other relief associations, I believe there are three in total, there is a preference within PERA for these employees if they should opt to, and if there are positions open in PERA, they would have a modest preference over other applicants in filling those positions. So, members, that's the quick general summary of the bill. The memo that you have from me, dated May 21st, has a section-by-section summary, which will give you more detail on each of the provisions in the 14A amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have prepared statements. It was supposed to be a joke, but as you can tell, though, that this agreement is historic. I think it's a 30-year work in progress, and so this is huge. And I would like to thank all the people that have been involved in making this agreement come to fruition. There are several principles that I just definitely want to point out. It is totally voluntary, and the pension fund members have to vote on it and approve on the legislation on a majority vote. The Minneapolis City Council has to approve on it. Number three, PARA has to approve it. And number four, the SBI determines what assets it receives. And if any one group does not approve the arrangement, the entire arrangement fails. And some of the other principles are that PARA is to be held harmless, and the pension funds and the city have to pay their own way, and there is no subsidy. Also, unlike the Minneapolis teachers and MRF bill, there are no new state aids in this bill, and there won't be. Number three, the retirees and the widows get a benefit adjustment that is appropriate, and they're going to PARA and giving up their escalated pensions, post-retirement benefits, and the 13th checks along with a health insurance program. In exchange, the retirees will have an increase and the stability of being in a larger fund. Also, the membership, the city, and the Minneapolis business community support the benefit increase in the bill. The city gets significant short-term and long-term property tax relief, and the Minneapolis business community strongly supports this property tax relief. The city also gets certainty in its levy and no longer bears the risk of stock market crashes. The city saves by not paying for two pension fund administrations. The state's interest is that the policy of the Pension Commission has been to support consolidation of what were once 47 plans, and now there's only two plans left, and one of those is mine. The state also will be more able to control and address pension policy. There is no new state money in this bill. The city has agreed to pay more if the state changes the interest rate assumptions. And in other consolidation, the state took the risk. But in this case, we're making Minneapolis bear the risk. And I hope that is very clear, because we don't want any misconception there. We do have many people here, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you would like to hear from the Minneapolis City Council President, Ms. Barb Johnson, the Executive Director, Mary Vanek from PARA is here, and representatives from the police and the fire associations are also here.
If there's testifiers that would like to, they can start bringing them forward.
Thank you, Larry. Don't go too far. Thank you.
Please state your name.
Barbara Johnson, Minneapolis City Council President.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for allowing us to present our agreement that we have reached with the Minneapolis Police Relief and Minneapolis Fire Relief Association. It is the result of a very long negotiation on behalf of the city and the funds, and we think offers stability and dignity for both us and our retirees going forward. As Senator Rosen said, there are a number of benefits that accrue to the city, but it also is a plan that respects people's retirement and provides them with surety going forward. So we very much encourage your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA. I just want to reaffirm what Senator Rosen has communicated. The PARA board's concerns have been addressed. We are party to the final agreement once all the steps are taken. And if there is a change in the investment return assumption, the amortization payment would be recalculated so that the police and fire fund is held harmless with respect to that. So our concerns have been addressed.
State your name.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Brian Rice, Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I serve as general counsel to both the Minneapolis Police Relief Association and the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association, and I'm appearing on behalf of both entities today. Mr. Chairman, both associations do support this legislation and appreciate your consideration of this matter. We would ask members of the committee to support it. The Minneapolis Fire Fund is 125 years old this year. Minneapolis Police Pension Fund is 121 years old, created respectively in 1886 and 1890. They're the two longest continually active public pension funds in the country. They have a long, proud history, but they've the funds and the city have been engaged in litigation now for nearly 5 years, and we see this as a means to resolve that lawsuit that's pending in the Court of Appeals. The funds believe their members are treated fairly in this bill in terms of their pension amounts and in terms of their structure going forward. And quite frankly, it's something the city's desired for, I think, over 30 years. The members now are at an age, the average age of the we're dealing with about 1,400 members here. About one-third of them are widows. Their average age is in the early 80s. There's 900 service pensioners. Their average age is in the early 70s. And quite frankly, it's just time to consolidate these funds with a larger, more stable fund that can provide adequate benefits and relieve concerns that they have, as well as assist the city in exiting the pension business. So with that, we'd encourage your support and be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all the stakeholders who have worked so hard to put this together, to the city, to the police association, the fire association, to PARA. Really appreciate all your hard work doing this. Thank you to all those great police officers and firefighters and the things that they do to protect and serve us. You know, for those who protect, we must protect them. And pension area is so important to our police and firefighters. This effort to consolidate is one of the key principles for the Pension Commission. And so we're moving in the right direction. I do have two questions that I want to ask, and I'm not assuming anything. I'm not stating anything by asking the questions. I don't know the answer, so I just want to put that on the table so we can discuss it. One is, as Mr. Martin talked about, the amortization aid. He said that there's $3.4 million currently. Is that annually or in a biennium?
Mr. Martin, is he still here?
And an associated question then with that is, since that's through 2020 for police and 2025 for fire, what is the impact by extending it to 2031, what that tail for that amortization aid? What's the financial impact?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, the $3.4 million figure, as I understand it, that's the most recent year's amortization aid. It is an annual amount. And the continuation would be at essentially that dollar amount for the period of time, either 2020 to 2031 or 2025 to 2031.
So,
Senator Daley,
a glimmer of Mr. Rice, who may have something to add to that.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, I would actually, I believe the number would be a biennial figure. My understanding is that the Police Relief Association receives $1 million a year in amortization aid, and the firefighters receive $700,000 a year.
Senator Daley?
I have no – the number I was reporting at 3.4 was the number I saw in testimony the other day in the Pension Commission, and it wasn't clear whether it was a biennial or annual number. So if Mr. Rice is closer to the numbers, I have no.
So what I'm hearing is nobody knows.
No dispute.
Gosh, let's, you know, this is what's frustrating. Either it is or it isn't. It's a pretty straightforward question.
Mr. Chairman, I will testify under oath that the Minneapolis Police Relief Association receives $1 million a year annually in amortization aid, and the firefighters receive $700,000. Those are audited numbers, and I can provide you to that information to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, so my important question as far as the impact to the state, as we extend this out, what is the financial impact of those additional years of amortization aid? What is that number?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, if I could answer that question, Senator Daley, that's an excellent question. The amortization aids that are currently promised in law will continue until a date in the future when the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund is fully funded. And the, I know that's got your eyes raising, but the commitment in the state to make those dollar payments continue and will be beyond the current amortization schedules for Minneapolis Police and Fire. There is, by adopting this legislation, the $1 million annual commitment to the Minneapolis Police would continue from 2020 until 2031. And for fire, it would continue from 2025 to 2031. Now, in effect, what this legislation does is devote those dollars from 2020 to 2031 for the police, $1 million a year, or $11 million, instead of the current law would have those aids go to a variety of other pension funds once Minneapolis Police was funded in 2020. There's a series of three or four other pension funds that would have, in essence, been the beneficiaries of Minneapolis Police being funded by 2020. Similarly, for Minneapolis Fire, which is scheduled to be fully funded by 2025, there would be another group of funds that would be entitled to their money once Minneapolis Fire was fully funded. But the aid program that's in the pension system would basically continue to fund other plans that, that hadn't been funded.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, I would submit that there is no, Mr. Chairman, Senator Daley, I would submit that there is no financial impact to the state at all. There would be, Mr. Chairman, Senator Daley, an impact on those funds that, since these funds aren't fully funded as soon as they were scheduled to be, those funds would not be receiving dollars after the year 2020 and after the year 2025 for a period of either 10 or 5 years.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question that I have is related to the assumed rate of return. The Pension Commission is discussing the possibility this summer, this fall, possibly, since the state rate or the assumed rate for the state of Minnesota is 8.5%, of possibly considering moving it to 8% or 7.5%. If we were to do that, how would that impact this legislation that we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Ms. Vanek would be the person to answer that question for PRA.
Welcome back, Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and Senator Daley, what this bill provides for is that at the point that a change in that assumption is made, the actuary would, from that point forward, recalculate the annual additional contribution that the city has to make, so that that revenue is the revenue that would be foregone by lowering the assumed investment return would be made up by the city.
Senator Daley?
Just want to make sure that the city is aware of that possibility and they're willing to take on that risk.
Yes, we are. Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, yes, we are.
Further testifiers that we have? Are you here testifying on the 14A amendment?
Well, that's what I was waiting to find out. That's why I hesitated. I think I'm supposed to testify on the bill in toto, so... Okay.